What an expectant audience, and rightly so. Thank you all for coming. My name is Tim Newburn. I'm a criminologist here at the LSE, and it's my privilege to be the chair for this evening's event, introducing Tom Gash, as I will in a moment, to talk about his book. As usual for these things, just a couple of bits of housekeeping, really, mainly just to let you know the format for this evening. After I start, Tom will talk for 20 minutes, half an hour or so, and then he and I will probably have just a conversation, as it were, open conversation for 5 or 10 minutes, and I'll open it to you for the questions. When there are questions, there'll be a roving mic. You should know that the whole thing's being podcast, so it's fine to swear, but just know that it's going to be recorded if you do, that's fine. Please do, if you can get a signal, I haven't actually checked, but please do use Twitter or any other social media you're using. The hashtag for the event is, it's the title of the book, to be fair, LSE Criminal. There are times in LSE's history when that might not have been the hashtag to use. Anyway, if you're going for it, Tom's Twitter handle is @Tom_Gash. Which is the other thing that you need to know. After the talk, there'll be a reception, so there'll be wine and nibbles and so forth. And crucially, there'll be a copy of the book at $14.99, which you can purchase and have Tom sign and immediately increase its value. I was going to say something else about the reception and the book. No, straight on to Tom. Without any further ado, let me introduce Tom, who, crucially for our purposes in a variety of ways, I think, used to be a senior advisor in the strategy unit at Number 10 in that era, I think, probably we these days call the Blair days. He's a senior fellow and senior advisor at the Institute of Government, and I'm delighted on our part to say he's a visiting senior fellow here at the Mannheim Centre for Criminology at the LSE. And these days, in addition to writing a great deal, he's spending or splitting his time between the Institute of Government and consulting work on criminal justice on a whole variety of other public sector and non-public sector issues. So it's with great pleasure I introduce Tom to talk about this. Really, you can tell, so look, colour-coded, I've read the whole thing, cannot recommend it to you highly enough. My great pleasure to introduce to you Tom Gash. Tom.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tim, and thank you to the LSE, the Department of Sociology, the Mannheim School of Criminology for welcoming me as well, not just here today, but also in my new role here as a visiting senior fellow. Thank you particularly to Jennifer Brown, who got me involved. This is obviously a special place, the LSE. It's a sort of place where people come together and share ideas. Today it's a particularly special place for me too, because among you in the audience, I've carefully dotted a lot of my friends and family and other people. There's also, I'm sure, many of you who are, like me, extremely interested in crime, and it's great to be able to have this conversation with you. What I want to do today is not to give you a line-by-line account of my book. We definitely don't have time for that. But to try and convince you of one of its central arguments. I want to convince you that we can make very small changes that can dramatically reduce crime. We tend to think that big problems need big solutions, but I'm going to argue that that's not the case. I'm also going to argue that many of the big solutions that we typically reach for when trying to tackle crime as policymakers, but also when commenting on crime in the media or when we're down the pub with our friends, are probably not just unhelpful, but sometimes counterproductive. The most important goal of my talk today, though, is to persuade you to re-examine your own views and beliefs about crime. If you have an underlying assumption that you think tough sentences will be the way to dramatically reduce crime, then I want you to question that belief. If you have the assumption that the only way that we can reduce crime is by tackling poverty or inequality, I want you to question that assumption as well. My experience has persuaded me that your views do matter when it comes to crime. So working with policymakers here and overseas, you realise that politicians, much as we like to say they ignore public opinion, are in fact very much affected by it. That's why they conduct focus groups, that's why they pay money for surveys. Likewise, we tend to think of the media as this sort of external force that is forcing its views on us constantly. But the media, as much as anyone can see, also panders to the views, the preconceptions of their readership. They also respond to our views of crime and play them back to us in a sort of perpetuating circle. More important for me is that our views of crime affect our views of society and our views of humanity, how we relate to other people in the world as we go about our daily lives. Obviously, our views of crime affect our views of people who have committed crime and how we relate to them and associate them. Our views also affect how we protect ourselves, our family members and others from the harms of crime. You've probably already got quite strong views on crime. Because unlike when I introduce myself as a consultant, when I say I work in the area of crime, people suddenly want to have a conversation. They want to talk about things. Nothing kills the conversation at a dinner party like saying you're a management consultant, trust me. This is the opposite case. And when you dig a little bit deeper, you suddenly realize that actually everyone has their own underlying theories of crime, their own views of what causes it, what we can do about it. Those views are formed from many different fragments. Those, for some people, are formed by views largely pushed on them by the media or documentaries, but they're also formed by our own individual experiences, our experiences as victims, yes, and our experiences as perpetrators too. So we don't necessarily like to admit this, but if you take a careful look at the person next to you, there's a 9 out of 10 chance at least that they will have committed crime at some point in their life. Some of my basketball team are here, so if you're sitting next to them, I'm pretty sure it's higher. About a quarter of men who live their full life in the UK will pick up a criminal conviction at some point. It's a bit lower for women. So we all have our partial experience of crime. We also pick up fragments all the time. I actually think that our views also are influenced by crime fiction, the film and fiction accounts that we read, that we view. But these are fragments, and my view is that we all have a duty to seek out a broader view of crime, a deeper understanding, a look for not just the stories that are pushed on us by the media, but the more representative true stories that look at broader trends in crime, that look at patterns of crime in different countries. And to do so is to give us a fuller understanding of who we are and our society. My view that we can do small things to dramatically reduce crime started to form gradually over time. But one of the studies that most influenced me, I picked up after I was working at the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit in the mid-2000s. And it's a slightly strange study because not many people know about it, but it's about motorcycle theft in Germany. And it's by Pat Mayhew and Ron Clark. So some of you who are studying criminology, if any of you are, will probably know about it or know about them. What they found as they looked at patterns of crime and vehicle crime in Germany was that Germany had a pretty serious motorcycle theft problem. So about 400 to 500 Germans each day would walk out of their homes, workplaces, or from socializing with friends and find that their motorbikes had been nicked. 150,000 people each year found that their motorcycle was stolen. This was 1980. But Ron Clark and Pat, they tended to look at the data over time, and they noticed that gradually from 1980 onwards, this phenomenon of motorcycle theft that seemed to be extraordinarily problematic disappeared. Not completely, but within 3 years, by 1983, it had fallen about a quarter. By 1986, it had fallen to two-thirds of its 1980 level. This is a pretty fundamental change in terms of patterns of crime. And if you imagine a two-thirds reduction in any crime type that you care about and you think about the impact that that would have on society, then you can see how this sort of small change may contain some interesting secrets that we need to understand. So what happened? What was this fundamental new strategy that Germany had pursued in terms of crime reduction? What had they done? Had they increased the sentences dramatically? Had they done something around the employment schemes in the area? What could it possibly be? Well, the answer, as it turns out, was probably that the Germans had discovered that road safety was an important issue for German citizens. In the mid-70s, they introduced seatbelts in the front seat of cars. In 1978, they introduced a law that made it illegal to drive a motorbike without a helmet. Now, how could that law, which was increasingly enforced over time with fines for people not wearing helmets by the early 80s, how could that law have made such a big difference to rates of motorcycle theft in Germany? Well, the answer, and we can be quite confident of this, is that, broadly speaking, what happened is people who commit crimes of stealing motorbikes are not doing so in a planning way. They're not actually saying, I'm going to take my motorcycle helmet out, find myself a bike, get on it, put my helmet on, and drive home. They are not really thinking and planning in that sense about the crime that they're going to commit. Much more opportunistic behavior is going on than that. And actually, but people are also influenced to a degree by the likelihood of getting stopped and checked by the police if they're not wearing a helmet. So very interesting small change in law, not even intended to tackle crime, had a fundamental effect. We can be pretty confident that that was what was going on, because when similar laws have been introduced in the UK, in the Netherlands, and even in India, similar results occurred. And we can also see that because other crime types in the area didn't fall in the same way. So I think this is not just a serendipitous oddity. I think it's a fundamental case that explains to us some real truths about crime that are often missed from most of our contemporary accounts of crimes and causes. First, it shows that opportunism and lack of planning that's present in most criminal activity, in my view. Of course, some crime is planned and carefully planned, but not the bulk of crime and harm that affects society. It shows to us the possibility of intervening in the moment decisions to reduce crime, to change people's choices and behavior. It shows it's possible to do that without the threat of tough punishment, and it shows us that it's possible to do that without radical social engineering. But it's an accident. And so one of my questions was always, well, can we learn from this, and can we do this stuff deliberately? And fortunately, other people have tried to do that. And when they've done so, they've achieved incredible results. In my book, I cover several different examples of how we've dramatically reduced crime by making small changes. So in the case of motorcycle theft, you can see exactly the small changes that made a difference. But you can see similar stories around the reduction in car crime in the UK. So car crime today, in terms of actual theft of vehicles, is 1/6 of the level that it was about 20 years ago, in fact, 15 years ago or so. And so that dramatic change is largely to do with changes in vehicle security. The other change that I cover in the book, which is definitely worth looking into, is around metal theft. One of the most frustrating crimes if you're in the world of crime reduction, because criminals gain very little out of metal theft. They melt most of their metal down for scrap and sell it. Occasionally they sell on bits and pieces at very low cost. In terms of what the impact it has on the economy, it's absolutely phenomenal, because often people are stealing metal from train lines, damaging vital infrastructure, destroying our cultural heritage. There was a Henry Moore statue that, as far as we know, was melted down and sold for scrap, which is a rather sad state of affairs. But these aren't the examples I want to focus on today. I want to talk about something that I hope you will all refrain from later, but it's alcohol-related violence. And we do have drinks outside, so I do think be very restrained. I'm not naming any names. But we Brits do tend to get a little bit rowdy when we've had a drink. That's why we can see patterns of crime when you look at all the statistics that show that, broadly speaking, when people go out and drink, they tend to have many more violent confrontations. We know this to be true, but we're not the only ones who like a drink. Richard Wortley is a professor, and he is the director of the Centre for Crime Science at the Jill Dando Institute at UCL. And he's an Australian, so he knows a thing or two about drinking as well. And not just because he's an Australian, but because he also has studied drinking phenomenon in his country and worked with a range of different agencies in a place called Surfers Paradise. Now, I don't know if any of you know Surfers Paradise. I've got a few nods. This is very good. It's a place that's not got a very large natural population, but tends to swell very dramatically at certain times of year, like the end of school term, when everyone descends on it for these massive celebrations, which just involve drinking a lot. And they started to realise they have a serious problem with alcohol-related violence. And it was causing incredible costs in terms of health service costs, in terms of policing. It was also affecting the attractiveness of the area and obviously the reputation of the area and the people who felt they were in charge of it at a political level. On the newspaper front pages in Australia at different times of this time of year, you tend to get these brilliant pictures of people sort of lying with their legs in the air and their pants showing, and someone else with someone covered in blood from their latest fight. So the problems were not just sort of trivial and to laugh about. They were also leading to deaths. One of the things that's happened in Australia is there's been a lot of publicity around what are known as one-punch killings, where people actually get into what may be seen as innocuous street fights, but one punch and a fall to hit the head on the pavement leads to death. These are quite dramatic consequences as a result of alcohol-related violence. So what did they do about it once they'd found they had enough of the problem? Again, they made very small changes, but in this case, they made a sequence of very small changes. First thing they did is to try and reduce alcohol consumption in sort of intelligent ways. So some of these things are slightly nudgy. They are making glasses smaller, for example. I'm not sure many of my friends would like that one. Fewer discounts that encourage binge drinking. Many fewer binge drinking incentives, particularly early in the evening. Snacks, food to allow people to absorb the alcohol, do something different other than drink for a bit. There was a big change around managing clientele. And this happens, has happened in a range of areas of life. Tim and I were talking about the Hillsborough disaster and the change in the nature of football and going to the football that's occurred over recent years. But in the context of pubs and bars, one of the things you notice about fights is it often takes two people to get into a fight, and both of them kind of want to be willing to have a fight. That's not always the case. Sometimes you get unprovoked attacks, but lots of the violence that happens in these spaces need two people who want to fight. Now, if you've got 100% of people in a venue who are okay with having a fight, then you get a lot of fights. If you have 50-50, you get a lot fewer fights. So mixing clientele seemed to be another strategy they thought was worth investigating. The other thing they did was started to think about managing the clientele more effectively in the venue and reducing conflict and cutting it off before it escalated too rapidly. So lots of work with door security staff and other people who are managing places and bar managers and so forth. Now, these all seem like really, really small changes, right? You know, what possible difference could these things make? Well, they added up to a 52% reduction in violent assaults within a year of their implementation in Surfers Paradise. A really, really dramatic, fundamental shift in patterns of crime as a result of really small changes. Now, again, I think this reinforces those important lessons about crime that I try and share as much as I can within the book. Again, the importance of those in-the-moment decisions. And I, in a sense, didn't need to read lots of academic research to know that there are some people who will go to a pub and get into a fight one week but not get into a fight the next week. What is it about the changes in their environment that means that their behavior is so different on two different occasions? We like to think of ourselves as beings in control of all of our own actions, but we are fundamentally influenced by our surroundings and our circumstances. Likewise, it reinforces the view that you don't need tough sentences to reduce crime. But more than that, it actually raises questions about the role of the criminal justice system overall in reducing crime. Notice that it wasn't the police who were changing their approach to managing clients. It was bouncers and door staffs. One of the things that we've changed in the UK, which was about time too, is we've got much tighter on not letting people with criminal records work on the doors of clubs and bars, for example. A very important step in the right direction. The other thing it obviously points out again is that message around, well, we can do something about this specific problem without doing broader social reform. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do social reform, but you can reduce crime without it. Now, when I say that these important in-the-moment decisions are the key to understanding crime and reducing crime, I get a number of different counter-arguments. One of them is that we won't solve the whole problem this way. And I say, well, that's true. But it will fundamentally help you tackle the problem. And there are also small changes in other areas that can make a big difference too. So just as small changes can make a difference in terms of reducing the opportunities for crime, we can take advantage of detailed knowledge of people's lives and decisions when it comes to things like reducing their reoffending. So one of the things that, you know, we should look at trying to take advantage of is the fact that when people's friends die of drugs overdoses, it's a possible moment of intervention, a time in which you can help to either avoid a downward spiral or to find a chance for people to go into recovery. The other thing I'd say about this argument that it won't solve everything is I think it's been more important than many people recognise in actually contributing to what has been one of the big social trends that often goes missing over the last 25 years or so, which is that crime has fundamentally reduced, not just in the UK, but across developed countries. Crime rose dramatically in the post-war period, and that was quite surprising to some because it was a time of unparalleled wealth and prosperity, and everyone was thinking, oh, well, this must be good for crime rates. It rose, and now it's subsequently fallen. And some of the things that we know from different studies have made a difference in respect to that crime drop are quite small, but they're all about people and businesses taking action to protect themselves in different ways. So it might be post offices realizing that if they want to avoid too many hold-ups, and this is back in the day when we had armed robberies, we still had the one at Hatton Garden, which is very peculiar, but still happened. Back then, they actually started to put in place glass screens to protect their workers, made a difference. They most fundamentally, in terms of local shops, started carrying a hell of a lot less cash. So, you know, if you want to know one way of stopping people from stealing cash, it's getting rid of the cash. Other examples relate to street lighting in areas where muggings might be happening, blocking off back alleys. This can not just affect burglary in the UK, you can also cut off roads in ways in the US that has actually fundamentally changed drive-by shootings and other examples like that. So this manipulation of sort of social spaces to reduce the risks of crime has been important in my view, and I think underplayed and something that may have made quite a big difference. Another counter-argument is that, well, this must just push crime into other places, right? So you cut it off somewhere else and it goes somewhere else. Oh, what's the point of doing it? We're just pushing the problem into a different area. Well, of course, that doesn't seem to be the case. And if you think about the alcohol-related violence example, you can see why that probably isn't the case. Because sometimes people get frustrated and sometimes they don't. And if you can reduce them getting frustrated, it's one less time they've been frustrated, one less crime. There's also been a study of about 102 different academic reports looking at this method of reducing crime, which is known as situational crime prevention. And what it tends to find is that in hardly any of them, in fact, in none of them, I think, was the crime completely displaced to another location. In 68 cases out of 102, there was no displacement at all. So in 68 times out of 100, 68% of the time, you get no substitution. So you reduce a crime somewhere, nothing else goes wrong. But also, very interestingly, you also get a diffusion of benefits in certain circumstances, and you can actually understand why that might happen. So in other words, if you reduce alcohol-related violence in a club, you might also get benefits around the club and the venue, because actually people aren't as attracted to going to the place, don't get in the habit of having a fight on every Friday night. You can see how these sort of patterns, positive patterns, can start to emerge for our behaviour, and I think they're important. Another counter-argument we get, of course, is that this neglects the importance of tough punishment for justice reasons and the importance of social reform for reasons of social reform to try and make society fairer and better for people. And I would say on that second point that it's not that I don't care about poverty or inequality. Those are fundamentally important things, but the communities that are often most affected by crime are those that are the poorest, and we have a duty to spend our money in the most cost-effective ways to support those people and to reduce their chances of victimization. So the other question I get is, so, okay, if it's all like this, why aren't we doing more of this stuff? Why can't we just do loads of it? I think the first thing to say is I think this is becoming much more current, much more accepted as a way of tackling crime, and more is being done. Those examples I talked about in terms of what businesses are doing, for example, are becoming more current. One of the things you'll notice around the question of cybersecurity, that everyone talks about in a sort of scary way, you see that the banks are actually taking lots of actions themselves. So you may notice that you used to just go online and you just type in a password. You've now also got a chip and PIN thing that you have to plug in. It's a bit frustrating, but you still do it anyway. So lots of businesses are actually taking on these crime prevention techniques to reduce crime. There are also other things that are being done in lots of different parts of the country, and they're often localized, but important. But the other reason we're not doing more, and sometimes we could do more, is because it's very hard to suspend knee-jerk reactions to political crises. So one of the things you know is that whenever there is a high-profile incident of crime, what do people think of as the policy response? Because it's normally when there's a specific incident. There's either, it could be a riot. Remember all that debate we had about crime during the riots? Or there's a specific case of some extreme type of violence. And the response that's encouraged in response to that by the papers is normally something about the individual for punishment, or it's something that's broad-based and social. And it doesn't very often get into the details of the moments in which people make their decisions to commit crime or not. And I think those moments are critical, and I think they're what we need to focus on, because I think those are the areas where we can make the small differences that can dramatically reduce crime. So my book is about creating the space for those changes to be made, to try and reduce our reliance on some of the big myths about crime. I haven't fully dispelled all the big myths about crime, but hopefully I do a good job in the book, so you'll have to read the whole thing. But there are lots of these myths that get in the way of our sort of logical approach to reducing crime in a cost-effective way. There are myths about that immigration will automatically increase crime rates, the myth that we need more bobbies on the beat rather than actually we need to put our police in the right place and have the right sorts of police officers and the right culture around them. There are myths about biology and the way that actually who we are in some genetic way will determine our behaviour. These all get in the way, in my view, of these more fundamental approaches to reducing crime, these things that we know work, these in-the-moment changes that we can make dramatically make a difference. So my entreaty to you today is to ask you all to suspend your assumptions, to suspend your preconceptions about crime, to consider that actually we might be able to make some small changes that can make a big difference, and to recognize that we need to dispel crime fictions and replace them with crime facts. Thank you very much.
Great, Tom, thank you very much indeed. As I said, everyone, I'm going to take the opportunity just to ask Tom two or three questions to kick things off, and then I'll hand over to you. So if you haven't already thought of your questions, there's 5, 6, 7 minutes to get them in order, and there'll be microphones coming round to you. Tom, thank you. It's a great talk, and it's a great book, and I have genuinely read every word, every page. I've even anally retentively read lots of the footnotes and things as well, being an academic, sad man that I am. Now, one of the things that always interests me, and we don't actually talk about very much in universities, oddly, given we spend huge amounts of our lives doing this, is writing. And reading the book, I mean, even anticipating reading the book, but then reading it, I was aware that there was a challenge. And the challenge is, as you admit, the issues that you're talking about are inherently complicated. These are complex things to which, as you say, probably disappointingly to lots of people in some ways, there are no simple solutions. But the challenge for a writer is to, and for a book published by Alan Lane, Penguin, and so forth, with a publicity machine behind it, is to write for a big audience, accessibly, to reach lots of people. And I'd be interested to hear just a little of your reflections about how you did that, what you were attempting to do, and I think, which to my eye has been achieved extremely well, but what you had in your mind as you were writing the book.
So it helps to talk about why I really wrote the book. And I think essentially there's a lot of frustration in there from my time in policy. So I had a lot of conversations with people who were making policy and academics as part of this work. And I used to say, well, look, you've done this, there's this amazing study. It's really dense and really hard to sort of read, though, and not even the minister can understand this. And so I will try and translate it for you. But there was also a lot of complaints about public opinion from those people as well. There was a complaint that actually it's like, well, if only the public recognised that this was the right answer. And so what occurred to me was actually, well, who's giving the public any of this information? So my initial thought was, well, maybe I could try that. It's going to be really hard because I'm going to have to synthesise this huge amount of complex material into something that is fun and accessible. But I thought maybe I should have a go because no one else seemed to be doing it. There are some good books out there. I should mention Nick Ross's book from a couple of years ago, which had a crack at this. There's some other books over the decades as well. But that's where the book came from. And then when it came to actually sitting down and doing it, then I have to sort of confess that the process was definitely not easy. And one of the things that I got into trouble with initially, I think, was that I was trying... At the one hand, I sort of knew what the truth was, but I was trying to give a really strong argument on something in a particular direction. I was trying to say something like, poverty makes absolutely no difference to crime. I was trying to give that sort of type of argument because I thought that would be really counterintuitive and the public would like it, and it's kind of a bit true. But in a sense, I changed my approach. There was a moment of revelation when I realised that actually, if I wasn't honest in what I was writing, then I wouldn't be doing the readers a service. And in a sense, the readers are cleverer than that. Everyone I know and speak to about crime is cleverer than that. They kind of want the easy answers, and they will remember them, and so I give plenty of easy answers. You say there aren't simple solutions, but I actually think those examples we just talked about are actually very simple, specific solutions. They just aren't simple everything solutions. And so I try and give people the simple answers to grab onto and the big concepts and the big ideas, but also to let them see, like, where I'm not sure and where the complexity is, because these guys will figure it out, right? They're all smart people, and if I can show them where I'm not sure, they can make up their own mind a little bit as well.
No, thank you. I mean, the phrase, it's kind of a bit true, I think it's what we find ourselves sadly saying all the time in academia, and just wishing we could say something firmer. But leading on from that, so... And you don't need to say anything too explicit, but it'd be nice if you did. The strategy unit and the Blair government and all that. So one might say provocatively that the various Home Affairs spokespeople, I name none in particular, said a variety of things that were kind of a bit true about crime policy, but maybe not as accurate as we might always have hoped. And I wondered what other reflections you might be willing to share about...
Yeah. So I was quite a junior person in the big scheme of things, and so my reporting line was into a special advisor who was more on the political side, very attuned to the Prime Minister's interests and views of what he wanted to happen, and so it went through him and into the PM, who I met a few times, but wouldn't say certainly I couldn't pick up the phone and say hi Tony, how's it going. But, we spent a lot of time trying to stop crazy shit from happening. And that is part of the job, because what you're dealing with is a very fast-paced environment where people want quick answers to a specific political issue that's been framed in a certain way. And they kind of want an easy answer, but eventually they get to the point where they realise actually they're going to have to make tough, difficult decisions. But you need to take them on that journey and show that you've thought about all of the easy options that they thought about, and unfortunately the easy option one won't necessarily work, easy option two won't necessarily work, easy option three, there might be something to it. If we just changed it a bit, that could be sort of a sensible direction to move in. So there was a lot of stopping stuff that was not necessarily the right thing to do to happen. The other thing about the job is that often the problems are framed in really funny ways when they come at you. You'd like to think... So I did get one brief, and I'm not sure whether I meant to say things like this. So one brief said, what more powers should we give to the police, or something like that. Which additional powers can we give to the police to take more action against crime? So in a sense, the answer is in the question, right? You know which direction this is coming from. And so in that context, you have this really tricky challenge, which is if you come back and say, I completely disagree with the premise of your question, that's going to go down like a lead balloon. These are people who clearly have a view on which direction they want the answer to be in. And so you're constantly navigating all that stuff, which is a little bit messy. One of the things that I did have to deal with when I was at the strategy unit was there was a real crisis in the prison population. And there we basically reached the stage where lots of senior officials in the Home Office in the UK were meeting on a very regular basis to say, where do we put the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people? It was really acute. I'm looking at someone who's probably there at the time. That was a really odd situation. But there was, at the same time, a request for some work to work out whether we could both take some minor offenders out of prison and do some more tough stuff to the more serious offenders. Now, a lot of the job there, again, was basically saying, well, let's have a look at the data on who's in prison. Let's actually just go and examine this. It's all in the detail. And so if you think that our prisons are filled with first-time driving offenders, you are very much mistaken. You would be shocked by the number of offences many people in our prison system have. It doesn't mean that some people might not be better served by community punishments or other interventions. But the first thing we had to do as advisers to the political side is you just need to get them onto the page where they recognise that what's in a prison at the moment, what kind of people are there, what are the issues, what are the problems. So a lot of it is about good communication of the facts that many academics would know. And at the time, one of the things I struggled with, of course, was that I'd been brought in from a business management consulting background. And so what was my knowledge of this stuff? And so I reached out to a lot of academics and tried to problem solve and solve all this stuff. But there is also a sense in which this is the common environment for political decision making. You will have a lot of people around who are very smart and very capable of turning information around, but don't necessarily have a depth of experience and perspective on the issues they look at. Again, that's why another reason I wrote the book, to try and shove this into their hands, so that when people get thrown these difficult jobs, they can have a place to start.
One more on policy, and then I've got loads here, but I must hand it over to others, which is argue absolutely rightly in the examples that you use in terms of successful crime reduction and intervention that the policies that worked, well, not necessarily policies, but the things that worked were motorcycle helmets or things to do with licensing hours or the size of glasses or who is and isn't allowed to be employed as bar staff and a whole variety of other things. We typically talk about crime policy as something which is owned historically by the Home Office, these days by the Home Office and Ministry of Justice. But actually, just thinking about framing my question, is there any such thing? We have prisons policy and probation policy or whatever, offender management policy and police policy and a variety of other things. Do we really have crime policy? And if we did, or if we do, but if we are to have it, where should it be in government?
So the book sort of suggests really that you need to have your decisions all at different levels. So on the one hand, I want my government to be having a conversation with Apple right now about product design. I want to make sure that the next iPhone that is out there is harder to nick, easier to trace. I really want to think about that.
Has a better battery.
Exactly. It has a better battery, all those other things that people... Well, this is one of the interesting things about iPhones, of course, and actually about the way in which you structure, how you genuinely reduce crime. One of the things that people tend to do is they tend to absorb all those costs and not worry about them that much because they care about other things. It's a bit of a problem, actually. But you need that sort of top-level thing, and you might want to speak maybe at a regional level to some of your maybe your building suppliers or something who are designing some of the new housing areas in the country, who might want to think about how they're designing their spaces to make sure that they can reduce crime. And then at a really micro local level, you might want to be thinking about, well, okay, so who are the people in your area who've got substance abuse, mental health problems that also commit a lot of crime? What services are in place for them? How can you do something about it? And it's very, very micro. And so the problems come effectively when the people at the top think they can make those decisions that need to happen at the bottom, where they go, we're going to have this new national program for whatever, and don't think about allowing the space for it to be tailored to the local circumstances and situations. So, I think actually in that sense, some of the moves that are going on are now, the government is trying to devolve some of the justice budgets to, they already have announced they're going to devolve them to Greater Manchester. They may get tempted into moving some of those to London as well, looking at courts, prisons, probation budgets, starting to think about actually how local areas can have more control over their own ecosystem. And then I think you can start to have a more interesting conversation about crime reduction. In London at the moment, there's a mayoral debate where basically everyone says we're going to have more coppers in London. And this is really quite, it's obviously very, very basic. More coppers instead of what? Because I'd frankly take some of your coppers away and give you some mental health practitioners, and I might even think about doing something around engagement with business instead or something. You know, all sorts of different things you could do to spend that money better. That's not going to be the political debate we have, right? Everyone's going to still say we want more bobbies on the beat. And what's more, they're going to be most vocal in the communities that definitely don't need more bobbies on the beat in outer London. That's the current mayoral debate. So we need to, that's why I think, again, it's a slightly incumbent on everybody. So it's a slightly weird dream that I have that everyone can be a bit more informed about crime so that they don't instinctively say, we want more bobbies on the beat, please. But I think it does fall to citizens as to which arguments they're going to buy most easily. So it does fall to everyone here to say, actually, I quite like this guy because he's actually saying something a little bit more nuanced and sophisticated. Now, I don't know whether it will ever happen, but I can have that dream.
I think it's absolutely, and but then the implication of your argument about mental health practitioners of whatever sort means the Department of Health has a crime reduction responsibility in addition to its other things. Absolutely. Enough from me. I'm going to open it up. There are roving mics. If you put your hands in the air, I'll try to remember the order that you do it. And then please, so I've got one right in the middle to kick off with and one over there. Please introduce yourselves. And we've got about half an hour, but please try and keep the questions sort of reasonably brief. Thank you. And keep them to make them questions as well. That's always good. Thank you.
It's on. Okay, great. Hi, my name is Amina Adewusi. I'm an alumni of the LSE. Thank you very much. So are we saying that people do bad things because they're in bad environments and that it's not the people themselves who are bad, just the situations we put them in?
Okay, straight away. I think that's a great question. And what I'm sort of saying is, that is half of the equation. So half of the equation, at least, is probably something to do with the situations we put people in. Different people, we all have different predilections towards crime. We are all more, some of us are more willing to bend the rules and break the rules than others, but we can often all be tempted. And some people are put in those situations of temptation much more. Some people also have got personalities and ethics and values and things that mean that they will be more likely to break the law, but they will still commit more crime if they have more opportunities. So even those people will be affected by the opportunity structures. But I don't think that we can't do anything about people's propensity to commit crime. One of the interesting things that was a big theme actually throughout the 2000s and still is this idea that you can actually support people to develop more effectively in sort of early life. And a lot of that is really about helping people to cope with temptation, stress, adversity, impulse control, all of that sort of early years upbringing stuff. Now, we used to think that that was all about the first 3 or 4 years of life. There was this real dogma around those early, really early years. And now the evidence is gradually from all the different academic work saying actually people change throughout their life courses and you can do things at different points in time. And I think that's really encouraging because actually it allows us to intervene a bit more effectively, I think, because sometimes at that very early stage you don't know who's going to get into trouble or not, although people say you can spot them. And the other thing about those early interventions is, in my view, this is philosophically but also practically, I don't think those should be framed as about crime reduction. People who commit crime tend to have a lot of other bad outcomes in life. Because, I mean, there's a chapter in my book that's a lot about the marshmallow test. The marshmallow test is the test that you give to kids, and you say, well, if you don't eat the marshmallow before the end of the lesson, you can have another marshmallow. Now, they do this in psychological experiments, and you can see it on YouTube videos actually now as well, and you can watch these little kids sitting there looking at their marshmallow and going, if I just wait for 5 minutes more, I can have my marshmallow. But some people can't. They just literally, as soon as the person's gone out of the room to the invigilator, they just, boom, it's gone. And a lot of those skills and ability to sort of delay gratification and things like that can be developed. But they help not just in terms of future crime and criminal behavior. They help in terms of employment outcomes, in terms of health. Because, you know, obviously, if you eat all the marshmallows, what happens? So there are all sorts of other outcomes that help. And if you start framing stuff that's meant to be helping people as about stopping them from doing the bad stuff, rather than about having a positive view of what they can contribute to society and life, I think you're going about things the wrong way. And I think we've done that a couple of times in terms of policy interventions, and I think it's neither very nice nor very effective, because people immediately disengage, and they will say, well, what are you talking about? This is my kid. Why are you treating me like I'm raising a criminal? And it comes across, and so you shouldn't frame things in that way. And I think we should have a much broader view of well-being and people's capacity to cope and make the most out of life that isn't just about crime.
Thank you. I've got a question on the left there, yeah, and then also coming up on the back right.
Hi, Emily. I'm a criminal justice policy student here at the LSC, and you kind of touched on this, but I was wondering if you could go into a little more depth. So you talk about situational crime prevention and individuals having an impact on crime reduction, and I'm curious to know what role you see civil society having in this field and potential conflict with the role of the state.
Mm. Should we take the second one while you think about it? Breathing space.
A hard one. I take the second one and then we'll come back to it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. My question was involving drug-related crime and drug users and associated crimes that they would do. Approaches that you suggest or anything that you do to change, what would you... you could be accused of sanctioning drug use, and that sort of, if you're trying to manage it in another way, how would you come up against that, or what would you say?
So there's a bit in the book about drugs, and I completely duck the argument of whether we should... I don't completely duck it, but I basically duck the legalisation, not legalisation argument. But one of the things we have to recognise with drugs is that they are a market where there is supply and there is demand, and ultimately, as long as there's demand... basically, people will come and fill in the supply side. But in terms of users, we do know that there are actually lots of treatments and interventions that actually work. It's one of the areas where we can actually be really confident that if you get people into treatment, even actually, frankly, not always, they don't always need to want to engage. You can get people into treatment, and it can address the drug use problems that they have. So in one sense, I think there's an obvious solution there around drug treatment and scaling up what we do and doing more of that stuff. In terms of criticisms from people in terms of... what was your exact criticism of... What was the risk that you thought I was going to get? You thought someone was going to say something to me? Yeah. Oh, yeah, so taking minor crime. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think a huge... It's basically just it's a huge waste of money to go after people who are smoking cannabis and using drugs. I think it's just something where the police just need to direct their efforts towards things that would be more worthwhile and do more harm to society. There's a big issue with this, because it becomes a problem where you're sanctioning and putting those people into prison, because that becomes just a really expensive use of a really scarce public resource. I don't actually think the public want to see minor drug use being dealt with in that way. And yet where in some places, and I've seen it in certain countries and in certain parts of certain countries, you can see the police actually really clamping down on minor drug use. And so I think there's no justification for that, broadly speaking. Just can't see how it's a good use of public money. And I don't think the public would really support it if they knew what they were losing as a result of the police concentrating on that Oh, I've got to get back.
Bought yourself enough time for her.
All these clever people with these clever questions. So, civil society in its broader sense could probably... It obviously has a role to play, right? So if you're basically saying people coming together to deal with their community's problems, there's no reason, from my analysis, in fact, what you'd say is actually civil society already is doing a lot to reduce crime. People are coming together to reduce opportunities to tackle crime causes. In one of the things that governments have been doing a lot of lately, of course, is contracting with the voluntary sector to get them to provide services. And the challenge there, of course, is the same as it is in every other area, which is sort of, well, how do we measure what they're doing and whether it makes any difference? And so a lot of the problems there are actually practical. They're about gathering data and getting information and working out what really works and then sort of doing the things that work. And I think, again, I don't think that the voluntary sector, particularly if it's getting public money, should be exempt from any of that stuff. So my sort of worldview would be if you're getting public money, then we need to sort of evaluate how that's being spent because we've got the duty to the taxpayers in order to work out what's going on. I think in other areas, I think it'd be fantastic to get more philanthropic effort going into crime reduction in the UK. One of the stories I tell in my book is actually about the US, where they have a much more stronger tradition of philanthropic giving. And it's a story of Father Greg Boyle, who has got this fantastic set of businesses called Homeboy Enterprises, which gets lots of ex-GAM members from LA into employment and into a sort of a supportive environment fundamentally that helps to keep them away from crime and helps them to deal with their crime problems.
Thank you. Well, I've got certainly one at the back left, two at the back left there. Sorry, were you? No.
Hi there. Hopefully a simpler question for you, Tom. My name's Chris Merritt. I'm a friend of Tom's. I'm also a doctoral student in clinical psychology at King's College London. Tom, you talk about perceptions of crime and kind of misunderstandings and misconceptions. What do you think is the most misunderstood crime in Britain in terms of public opinion?
So I've got
apparently he's a friend.
So yeah. So I've got an answer to that question, but it's very hard to articulate. I actually think that sexual offences are probably the most misunderstood crimes in Britain. I think they're the most impossible for anybody to talk about. I think that no one would admit, for example, that situational factors might determine quite a lot of sexual offences. I believe that they do, and we should start thinking about what you can do about that. We need to, again, treat those crimes, even though they are emotive and they touch our core identity and frighten us in really fundamental ways, with the same sort of problem-solving practical approach, the common sense approach that I advocate. So one of the things that I think has probably would logically seem like it had worked to me, but it's never been evaluated, is one of the things that's changed around transport out of town centres was people used to rely a lot on unlicensed taxis. Get into cars with people you don't know, who have no, have never been vetted or accredited, and you're just getting into someone's car. And obviously that was highlighted and profiled as an issue some time ago, and that, I think, highlighting it helped make people a bit more safety conscious. But the thing that really made a difference was we now have Uber. You know, we can now jump into taxis much more easily, much more affordably, and don't get forced into those difficult choices that can just slightly increase the risks. I'm not saying it's anyone's fault if they do that and choose to take a taxi. They have every right to their safety. But in a sense, people are being given tools all the time to manage their risks. And I think sexual offences, for me, is one of those areas where we naturally default to the idea that the person who commits that kind of heinous crime is completely irredeemable, is out to do it, is a predator. Whereas actually, they certainly might not be someone I want to have dinner with, but they are people who are influenced by their situations and circumstances. And when you look at the details of a lot of the individual crimes that happen, you can see all sorts of situational factors as well as personality traits that are at play. So I think that's the tricky topic.
Thank you. Just behind there, I think, on the at the back.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Beth. I'm a neighbour. Hi.
It's going to be another difficult one there.
Yeah, another local.
My friends ask the hardest questions.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering, taking things away from the street level to a more corporate level, you know, and the truth about why these people do things, the bad things like all the tax evasion, what have you, which could be seen as being much more damaging to society than the petty criminals on the street.
That's a fantastic question, and it's brilliant because exactly the same set of things applies. So people with money are no different from the rest of us, and they are people who are affected by their circumstances too. There's a really interesting study done by people actually in relation to tax returns, which is that if you get people to sign their names telling that they'll be honest about what they say in future at the beginning of the form instead of at the end of the form, they're less likely to declare, which is a common thing in tax, basically declare less tax. So, funnily enough, just little nudges and changes in people's circumstances can change things. One of the things you notice about fraud, just to prove the fact that opportunity matters, is you look at all these different crime types and you notice basically these crimes are all committed by teenage boys. And some of them carry on into the 20s. Fraud sort of doesn't really get going properly until people hit their 20s and they've got proper jobs where they have the opportunity to commit fraud and they start to do it. And the same things apply internally. So you find that banks are actually taking a lot of effort to think about how they can reduce the opportunities for internal frauds and for those rogue traders to go off the rails, because it does happen. When you get someone like Nick Leeson put under sort of incredible pressure and strain, and he's also got some problems on the side and his family issues or whatever his story is, I don't know the detail of it, then you find perfectly willing to break the rules when they have the opportunity, and with really catastrophic results, as you say. I actually think that one of the things I'm really advocating, though, that is a bit different for corporate crime, is that when it's actually companies and businesses rather than rogue individuals within them that are breaking the law, that's exactly the scenario where they genuinely, those organisations, will respond to incentives in a way that the average street criminal might not. So one of the things I talk about is illegal tobacco trading and the role of big tobacco in at least allowing that to happen on a very, very large global scale to their benefit. Now, the way in which that was tackled over time was basically through very aggressive prosecutions and fines, because those are a set of players who really care about the risks and the rewards. They really are calculating the risks and reward. Whereas actually for a lot of the stuff where we're changing the sentences and we're making sentences tougher, it already doesn't make sense. It already doesn't make sense to kill your wife. Most of the people who've committed serious crimes don't get a lot out of them. They are already terrible decisions. And so we sort of say the solution to this, they wouldn't do it if we made this a really bad, if we made this even, consequence of this even worse. I'm like, how much worse do you want to get? So you read about these teenagers who've stabbed someone or shot someone, and their reward for this is basically, yes, they get some sort of street cred or whatever, but that's not a very long-lasting reward. Immediately what they get is they get an intense fear of reprisal from their particular behaviour, and then they get a 95%, if they live in London, they get a 95% chance of being caught and convicted and going to prison for an average life sentence of 21 years served. This is a terrible move. This is not the move of a sort of mastermind. Whereas if you look on the corporate side, you're seeing crimes where there is actually a payoff and people will respond to incentives. And we have plenty of evidence of how they do. And so I actually, funnily enough, want much more approach of a sort of purer incentives approach for that group of people. And for the other groups, more about nudging behaviour and influencing behaviour in more subtle ways and reducing opportunities, because it seems like sometimes not necessarily making the best decisions as it currently stands.
Thank you. I've got two. One here, and shall we take two together? There was one in the middle first. And then I'll take you, sir, afterwards.
Janessa?
Yeah.
Okay, hi. My name's Christine. I'm doing organizational and social psychology here at LSE. And because you were talking about collaboration with Apple and stuff like that, where do you ethically draw the boundary between, you know, nudging, framing people too much?
Okay, the boundary on nudging, and let's take the second one and we'll answer both.
Hi, I'm Yatta, a friend of Tom's. I think you make a really compelling case that some of the sort of small things have a genuine impact on crime. And as I suspend my prejudice about crime, I think you've succeeded in allowing me to do that. I guess the one thought that still plays in my mind is, to what extent does categories of crime and severity of crime have a bearing on this finding? So the examples you've given us are on, say, motor theft. Well, that versus gang crime, or antisocial behaviour versus violent crime. To what extent does the sort of same theory play out depending on what sort of crime we're dealing with?
So, good questions. On nudging, where do I draw the limits? I draw them quite broadly. One of the things about nudging is we are all already being influenced by myriad factors to inform and shape our decisions all the time. You know, and actually we let everyone do it all the time. If you've ever been to a supermarket and you're in the queue and you're just getting towards the counter, have you noticed how much chocolate there is? There's just so much chocolate. This is an incredible amount of nudging that's going on because that's a profitable item. It's also something that's actually quite bad for society in many ways. And so everyone's at it all the time, and I'm quite comfortable for governments to be at it for good reasons. The questions, of course, become then much more about, well, do you trust your government? Do you think you have a generally benign government? And I think that's where you get into a whole different set of questions about democratic accountability and how that works and how our political system works, which is huge and complicated. I definitely don't want to get into that. But I basically, as you can probably tell, I've got pretty broad tolerance for nudging people, because you're also nudging people away from breaking the law and doing bad things. So I think it's probably normally worth it, but it's an interesting debate, and it probably should be something you screen every sort of intervention again. It's like, is this really acceptable? Are we pushing the boundaries a bit too far? Miasa's question is great. The question you really have, I suppose, is, look, you're talking about all these minor things, right? You're talking about all these minor offences and maybe some of these really entrenched crime problems. These rules don't apply. These aren't situational in the moment decisions. These are too hard to change. And I sort of think that's, again, like, we just have to go into the detail. That's the solution, is to go into the detail. So you've got an interesting hypothesis there about gang crime maybe not being something that falls into this category because people are too embedded in it. And I'm like, well, sounds interesting, but everything I know about gang crime says that there are clusters of gang crime at particular times in particular spaces. And if you have one particular gang attack, and this is, the police already do this, that is the trigger point for a set of activity. There are sort of clusters of activity and triggers. And we can do stuff around those triggers and already try to do it to intervene to make sure that stuff doesn't kick off, basically. And so I think exactly on these crimes that are high harm, you can intervene. On antisocial behaviour stuff, I mean, this is sort of, there's a good example which my wife Eliza gave me, who I have to thank for helping me to write the book. She didn't actually write it, but she had to. she claims I should give her more space in the acknowledgements. I think she's probably right, because she had to put up with me basically working every hour of the day and every hour of the weekend for a long time. But on one of the things she highlighted, one of her friends who's a copper, and it's a really good story because it resonates with lots of other things I've heard, where there were a bunch of kids just causing trouble, and they were causing trouble every day, and they used to sit on the top of this bus shelter in where was it?
East London.
Near Tower Hamlets Way. And they used to sit there, and they used to basically intimidate people immensely because they're, like, high up, and they're shouting, and they're causing problems, and people didn't like it. So there's two ways of dealing with this. You can fundamentally go into their lives, you can try and change everything about them, you can give them all sorts of support, and, you know, get a wraparound intervention going for these kids who are clearly going off the rails. Or you can say, well, they're teenagers, let's see what happens if we move the bus stop. And so they moved the bus stop. And you know what? They found somewhere else to hang out. I don't know where that somewhere was, but they weren't as much of a burden and on the community. They may have just gone inside to play Xbox. I mean, who knows what happens? So I think these sorts of approaches have a lot more application than I think we might recognize. And I think we just need everyone to think about these types of solutions first and alongside the other things that we clearly need to do on a broader basis.
Yeah, I've got one at the back. I think there was a hand up. Yeah, you've got the microphone.
Yeah, hello. I'm nothing to do with crime whatsoever. I'm just a local businessman who came out of interest. I just wanted to ask about difference between strategy and tactics, because I've listened carefully to what you've said, and your philosophy seems to be a strategy backed up by data, following that data to prove an instinct, and then going to the powers that be and saying doing all these small things is a strategy to make a big difference. Unfortunately, you cut across political divide with many of your views. So the point you just made there about corporate crime versus knife crime in London and how those are treated with sentences, I think, is a classic example. There's no doubt there's a risk and reward issue there, but that cuts across people's often biased views. So how do you take this study, which is strategic, and apply it to a world that is full of uneducated tacticians, i.e. politicians? Thank you.
Yes. I wish me luck with that. I did an event last week, and Jackie Smith was a former Home Secretary, and she was there. And what you find is once you take politicians out of their immediate pressures and strains, they are incredibly reasonable and know exactly what the right answer is to do. The problem is that they feel a lot of pressure. They feel a lot of immediate pressure to respond to a particular crisis or incident. So I think the first thing you do is you don't ask politicians to implement these types of solutions in the heat of the moment, in that battle context. First of all, you have to sort of try and create restraint and calm and find the tactics, and this is the politics, for navigating through some of those political crises, you know, whether it's the J.B. Bulger killing or whatever it is, and then try and find a sensible way through that, to wait until that public fury has died down a bit and that people can start to think about some more active, proactive things. And then I think you can actually get them to engage, because fundamentally they would, I mean, politicians get a really bad rep, and sometimes rightly so, but some of them, you know, really, really care about doing the right things in terms of reducing crime. And so if you can get them engaged with the fact that this will actually give them results and make their communities safer, they're up for listening.
One more on the side there. I've got two there. Let's share the microphone. Let's take the two together.
The title of your book is quite interesting. Obviously, you've chosen it as quite a... my brain's gone, sorry.
Provocative.
It's very provocative. And I'm trying to find out whether or not buying the book will actually give me the answers that the title is giving me the impression of. I know that's quite a provocative question.
That's good.
Yeah, hi, my name is Suleiman. I'm doing my PhD in cybersecurity, and I would like to find out from you if the strategies you prescribe concerning the social context in relation to traditional crimes, if they are applicable to digital crime as well, because sometimes the circumstances are different. Yeah.
Thank you. I love the question about whether this book will tell you the truth about bad things, but obviously I'm going to tell you the answer is yes, right? So I suppose what I've already said is that half of the answer is about opportunity. Half of the answer is about reducing criminal opportunities. Another half of the answer is about motivations. It's about how can we change people's desire to do bad things. Because one of the things we don't ask ourselves enough, of course, is why is it that we don't do much more crime? Because there's a lot of crimes I could have done and got away with, I swear. But I decided not to do them for all sorts of reasons, not just selfish ones. So there's half sort of opportunity, half sort of motivation. And then I think the question is sort of, I think one of the truths is that the answer varies for different types of crime, for various different countries. And so what I try and do in the book is provide some of that distinction, the nuance, the layers. And so the answer is going to vary depending on the question that you ask. In a sense, that question is too big to have an interesting answer, because I can say it's opportunity and motivation. It gets more interesting when you get into some of the detail. Digital crimes, I recently decided that I was going to do some research on technology-enabled crime and what were technology trends actually doing to crime? Because I was hearing a lot of scaremongering stories about the way in which technology will really make us much less safe. And all the research that I was doing suggested to me actually that technology provides broadly speaking, the most people who can access the technology most effectively are those people who are most capable of using it to defend us against crime. And the big debates are actually about liberty versus security and how do we make those difficult trade-offs. But I think the same rules apply. And I think in quite worrying ways in one particular area, which I talk about briefly, which is one of the problems with the internet and the way it works at the moment, I don't know if people share this view, is that it's brilliant at funneling you towards content. That's what it does. It tries to push you into niches in different ways. It allows it sort of the search, and that's the functionality. But this causes really big problems for certain things. So obviously, one of those things is viewing child sex abuse images. So previously, people found it incredibly hard if they had an interest in younger women or boys or whatever to find any of that images anywhere. And now they're just sort of readily available on the internet. But what's more, if anyone searches out one of those things once, you can be guaranteed they're going to get a pop-up of something again. And there's a whole sort of route and world that people are getting nudged towards all of this content that we definitely don't want people to be seeing, and encouraging a set of predilections that we certainly don't want them to have. And so I've got big concerns about technology and the way that it nudges and shovels people towards crime. But equally, I think that in general, we've actually got lots of opportunities to prevent crime by using technology and digital information. I mean, we use immobilizers on cars. We've got all these things around swiping passes to get into buildings. These all make a huge difference. So I think that the same sort of principles apply, but we don't have all the answers yet. It's almost like, be really interested to see if you can come up with some in your work. But we definitely don't have the answers. It's just the same approach could benefit.
We're going to need to wrap up in a minute. I know there was one hand at the back there, and there's now one at the front here, and several more at the back.
Three.
Just use the words wrap up, and everyone puts their hands up.
Hi, Tom.
So
let's
take two or three, and until we've completely worn Tom out.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I'm Dave. Just got one question. I think you've touched on it quite a lot, and I think other people have, but... And this is coming from personal experience as well. I think the truth about why people do bad things, I think you can take this back to upbringing and straight into adulthood, but it's mental health, it's emotional health, it's... You touched on it when you said about, why isn't it I rob from the supermarket chocolate? It's because I've got the emotional health and the mental health and all of the correct upbringing to do that. So I think, the truth is, why do people do bad things? It's not always about their upbringing, but I think a lot of it is to do with some of that, and then it's also to do with maybe, their mental health in adulthood. And again, this is coming from personal experience. I'd like you to sort of, as a second part of that question, from that, what do you think about the women's population in prisons, and how many of those women are in there because of abusive emotional relationships from abusive mentally ill men? What are your thoughts on that?
Very good.
Okay, let's take another couple. If you can keep your questions fairly short, because we are going to run out of time. Sorry. That's the microphone. Yeah, my apologies.
Hi. I'm Emily. I used to study at LSE as well. So my question is about why people keep on doing bad things. So if we're saying that most crime's opportunistic or situational, do we then need to rethink policies regarding convicted offenders once they've served their time in prison or once they've committed their sentence or carried out their sentence? So things like having to declare a criminal record for many years after an offence, which is likely to have a very negative effect on future employment and therefore create another situation in which offending behaviour is more likely.
Okay. I'm going to take those two while the microphones move around.
Oh, yeah, sure. So the mental health point is, I think there is something there, and actually people who... And I'm much stronger on the situational stuff, to be honest, than on the personal stuff, because it's harder to analyse. I struggle with this in the book, and there is a chapter there on rehabilitation. And one of the things that you get when you speak to people who are working a lot with current and ex-offenders, and this probably relates a bit to your question as well, Emily, is that a lot of it is about finding... It's about people finding a role and meaning that they're comfortable with in life, that finding an identity that works for them and a way of living that works for them. And it's quite tailored and individual to that person. And it's quite hard to say, this is the answer, this is what will work for you. But I think there's something about, it sounds, when you talk about this stuff, you almost go into sort of religious or a different type of language. You start to talk about things like healing and fullness and wholeness. And I think that whole set of things is important and fundamental. But we have a very poor understanding of how to do that still, I think. I think, you know, our interventions around that stuff aren't always as good as they might be. On the women in prison question and how many are there with mental health, well, one of the things that got me into, before I went for the job at the Strategy Unit, one of the things that made me apply was I met a woman on a train who had just been let out of prison. And there was no doubt she had mental health problems. She also had a very abusive relationship that had got her into drug dealing. She had been committing a lot of crimes for a very, very long time. But there was a lot of damage around her and that relationship that was pretty severe. And it was very clear that it didn't do her a lot of good to be in prison, because she was coming out of it going to no job, not much hope for the future, and she had sort of 6 kids in care. So it was not a great scenario. So I think it's a really important area to look at, and there are loads of situations where it's the case. Ah, Emily. So what are the effects of criminal records on people? So in many cases it probably doesn't make sense, but I don't think it's so much about a crime thing. I think people overstate, from my reading of the research, is people overstate the relationship between employment and crime. So people are perfectly capable of being employed and committing a lot of crime. People without jobs are perfectly capable of not committing crime. What matters more is, it seems to be that one of the things that really helps people to give up crime is a meaningful job. So when you just give people any old job that doesn't give them any sense of identity or purpose, or a different set of satisfactions that is in some way pulling them towards crime, or the frustrations that gets rid of those frustrations, then I think that meaningful job thing is quite important. Most of the research says that that is a way in which you can make a difference for people. In terms of, I broadly think we've probably got slightly too many people, but not a lot too many people in prison in the UK. I think in the US they have way too many people in prison. And so there's a boundary there, because some people are genuinely a real danger and threat to society. I think there's a myth on the left, frankly, that you can let everyone out of prison and it will all be fine. But if you've been to prisons, you can meet some people who are really dangerous and difficult people, and they should be inside. But that's a really small subset, and there's a subset who dominate our sort of front pages of our tabloid papers. And then there's a big middle group that's really chaotic, and then there are some people with mental health problems or other things, needs that could be met, and they could be safely in the community or in different types of treatment. So really nuanced, difficult questions actually around how big our prison population should be. Probably my take, a little bit smaller than it is now, but definitely not nothing. And then in terms of criminal convictions, whole different question about how long you keep those lasting for, but probably not as long as we do now.
I think the microphones, there were a couple of hands up, one in the middle over there and one at the back, I think.
Thank you. I'm 15 years old. I'm in my school uniform, so you could probably tell. But I came here out of pure interest because a friend actually showed me this. And I do find it slightly interesting that obviously the truth about why people do things obviously isn't because they're bad people or anything like that, but it's simply because of the surroundings that they're in. But as a young person, it seems kind of obvious that that would be why people do bad things, that they're not bad people. So why do you think it will take such a long time, or actually it probably will take such a long time, for people or adults who can actually make these changes to actually make these situations not happen, probably, you know, avoid people doing the bad things? Why come they don't understand that, and I do? I don't know. I mean, it seems a bit funny, but... It's just a question, and I apologise. I did come in late, so if you've already answered this, I do apologise.
No, that's fantastic, and I'll go straight to it, because you're absolutely right, and there's something interesting in what you say, which is that when it comes to kids, we treat the crimes and misdemeanors that they commit when they're up to the age of sort of, you know, mid-teens, we treat them completely differently to if they happened for adults. You know, if kids get into a fight, you know, well, you sort of just tell them to learn to cope with their situation differently and sort of, you know, yada yada. If it happens among adults, obviously they can do a bit more damage to each other because they're bigger. We sort of immediately throw a criminal justice response at it, and we are more aware of protecting children from circumstances that where they're likely to go off the rails and do worse things. So I love your question. I thought it was fantastic. I just agree with it. Why is it hard? It's hard because people build up these other views. They build up the sense, as people get to adulthood, they love to be, there's this thing, there's a psychological phenomenon that many of you know called the fundamental attribution bias, which is basically that we think we're absolutely fantastic and in control of our destinies. I think we like to think, actually, that human beings have incredible control. We like to think of people as controlling their destinies and their surroundings. And so we are more drawn to, somehow, those things that will change people's motivations, that will change their views of what they do, than we are to what they'll do on the outside world. Because it's somehow affirming to us, I think. It somehow reassures us that we might be in control of the world out there and not just responding to it as it hits us daily. I think that's probably not true. Very good.
There's microphones with one final person, I think, and then we ought to probably...
Hi there. I'm Graham, and I actually work for a hedge fund, so I'm quite at home with this topic. But interestingly, I thought your argument had a lot of similarities to how I might approach building an investment portfolio, in that it's an equation of risk management. But here you are trying to minimize the opportunities to commit crime and maximize the effectiveness of your budget or effort to combat crime. Firstly, do you think that's a fair characterization? And if so, how far do you suggest taking that framework? For instance, individually detailed risk profiles of people, surveillance cameras, trying to nudge them in the right way at all times. Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's pretty fair. It also raises a really interesting question about how far do you go on that, how much risk are you willing to tolerate, because actually we make these decisions every single day about how much risk we're going to tolerate. We were redoing our bathroom, and we live above a shop in Highbury, and on the back window there were metal bars, and so I was like, oh, let's get rid of these metal bars, they look like we're in a prison, this is terrible, let's get rid of them. And Eliza was like, no, we need to keep the bars for security, it's going to make us safer, and then of course it affects your insurance premiums and all sorts of other things. And in the end we got rid of the bars. Why did we get rid of the bars? Because there's a trade-off between the benefit that I get from living my life a certain way and having a nice view out the window and having a slightly higher risk of crime. So in a sense, I'd like to give individuals as much choice as possible over the risks that they willingly take, but also make sure they're making their decisions quite consciously with good information. So I think that's one way of stopping it getting too nanny state-ish and in control, because of course one of the best ways of reducing crime is just to lock everyone up in a sort of 7-foot by 3-foot cube, and it wouldn't necessarily be the right thing to do. So there are limits. I think one of the things to do, of course, is to take a view of broader sort of social utility and other outcomes as well as just crime. I think we can get into trouble if you just have a crime lens on things. And so a crime lens works when you've got a really specific big crime problem. But when you're trying to do other things, I don't think you should run your hospital purely based on security concerns of the person like me who you've got in to say how you can make the hospital a little bit safer.
Brilliant, Tom. Thank you very much. I know there were more questions, but we're hurtling towards 8 o'clock, and so I ought to call things to a halt. Just as I was anticipating the last couple of minutes, thinking about how I'd wrap up, I thought, well, what have we learnt? And I can't do justice to it all, but two or three things. Firstly, we've learnt Tom's got a lot of friends. We've also learned that inviting your friends doesn't necessarily make the questions easier. So beware. More seriously, I think we've been reminded and we've learned that there is a huge amount of assumption, prejudice, call it what you may, about crime, misconduct, antisocial behaviour and so forth. And it's very important to try to park those, leave it at the door and keep a reasonably open mind about the things that we're trying to deal with. And that's of crucial importance in public policy terms. And we've been reminded forcefully, I think, that opportunity and motivation, if not the whole story, is a very significant element in the ways in which we might understand, but also intervene in the social world, whether it's a nudge or, I think, probably in Tom's terms, a shove. It was a hard nudge, wasn't it? No, occasionally. It's certainly happy with a hard nudge. Thinking about manipulating opportunity and motivation as a central and core means of managing one of the most significant public policy issues, but far from the most important. Thankfully, these days, it's no longer top of the political agenda, most important public policy issues that face us. So I'd like to thank you all for coming and for all the splendid participation. I'd like to thank Tom very much for a fantastic talk and for keeping going for a good, well, best part of an hour of questions. And I do urge you, before you clap, the book's outside, as I say, £14.99, not even a full £15, 2 days before it comes out into all good bookshops. So well done, and thank you very much, Tom.